This is the Oslo Governance Centre's Preventing Violent Extremism podcast series. I'm Annelies McAuliffe. Today, we're discussing strategic communications and preventing violent extremism. What works? What do donors want? What does the latest research show? I'm joined by four experts who have worked across Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Dr. Rawand Karadaji is based in Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. Rawand is the founder of multiple NGOs focusing on peace building. And he runs a production company that works on communications products for foreign donors.
I've been working in this field for over 5-6 years now. So we're trying to tackle extremism by creating content and disseminating it. So obviously we have our own obstacles to face here. So Iraq has become the hot area for terrorism for the past decade or so due to the political issues here. So we've been busy working in these fields.
Dr. Noor Huda Ismail is in Singapore. Huda is a visiting fellow at the S. Rajaratnam Institute for International Studies in Singapore. He's founder of the Institute for International Peacebuilding in Jakarta.
I'm a hybrid of three things, at least. I'm a former. I used to be part of the network myself. Many of my own roommates when I was 12 until, I think, 17, to become a terrorist. Then I run my own social enterprise, Cafe, where I help many formers, those former to start new life.
Jesse Lowry is the head of global activities and initiatives at the international consultancy firm Cosmopol. She's based in Abu Dhabi. She's a former senior advisor at the US State Department and was the US government's representative to HUDAYA as the Director of Dialogue and Communications.
I was formerly a senior advisor for communications and dialogue for State Department's Counterterrorism Bureau. Then I was seconded into HUDAYA as their Director of Dialogue and Communications. For about the last 4 years, I've spent over 5 years in the Middle East.
Michael Jones is a research fellow in terrorism and conflict at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute in London. Michael recently authored the paper for RUSI, Through the Looking Glass, assessing the evidence for PVE-CVE communications.
I'm a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, which is a UK-based think tank, primarily focusing on political violence, conflicts, and terrorism in East Africa.
So, let's get started. Michael, I'd like to start by asking you what you found in the research that you did for RUSI. The research focuses heavily on counter-narratives and how effective they are in countering and preventing recruitment and radicalization.
One of the things that was quite striking was the disconnect that these communication-based campaigns often have with sort of wider forms of engagement and interaction. So there's a lot of research out there that sort of suggests that, people aren't necessarily just recruited or radicalized by sort of seeing extreme content, be it online or offline, but it's also the sort of networks and socialization process that really sort of imbue that content with resonance and meaning. And I think therefore just trying to tackle the particular message or the particular sort of strand of communication without recognizing and responding to those wider sort of support networks, the wider sort of social structures that give that message its resonance and meaning in the first place, often leaves a lot of PCVE communications work fairly reductive.
Jesse, how are the donors going about designing these interventions at the moment? From somebody who's worked with donors a lot, but has also designed communications interventions for donors.
In my position, it was really interesting because I was on both sides. So, I was on the donor side, but then I also was on the implementing side. And so I think one of the things that Michael said about not factoring in the social network was something that was really big and something that was recognized right off the bat. So when we started to construct some of these programs, at least from the US side, and presenting some of these programs, especially in Africa, because it was so interesting to look at whether it was East Africa or West Africa, and looking at the economic and social ties as opposed to the MENA region. And we had some really effective programs that were more subtle in nature, and they were not in your face, do not join ISIS or one of the, you know, the truth behind Daesh. And so again, it goes back to thinking more outside the box. So coming up with different kind of programming to your donors and getting more local context, and then actually doing a lot more heavy research on the front end and then developing the programs.
Thanks, Jesse. Look, I want to turn to Rwanda and Huda now. What I'm interested in knowing, all of your local knowledge and all of your local networks, how do you design a communication intervention into Indonesia in your case, Huda? And how do you know that that is likely to work? So for example, with Rowan's work, a lot of it is focused on the use of humor, whereas a lot of the work that I've seen you do, it's very much focused on the emotional kind of approach.
Yeah. When I sit down with the donor, the first question that we discuss usually will very straightforward, what success look like for you? Okay, the success for us will be we want to target this. So when we agreed for the specific target between me and the donor, then I came up with an idea. You have to understand the specific target, you know, but of course, must be the blessing of the donor. But oftentimes, I'm the one who on the ground, we have to educate as well the donors. So my communication is a bit unusual. First, I literally create the credible voice. So I select which individual could be useful as my credible voice. When I am extremely aware the limitation of its credible voice, in my film Jihad Selfie, for instance, I have been following a 16-year-old boy who was about to join ISIS but end up not joining because he remembers his mommy. So for that very particular message, I understand this will be only working for people who really want to join but still in the question of whether should I join or not join. And that film also, I look at specifically the role of gender, which is masculinity.
Rwand, could you tell us how you work with donors and how you also make decisions about what kind of interventions are best for Iraq?
If we take the ISIL scenario, for example, and we take into consideration the recruitment process that happens to locals in areas in of Middle East, such as Iraq and Syria, for example, when you discuss these messaging methodologies with donors, they're very excited about what the social media statistics offer. But the actual key problem is that these social media mediums doesn't reach these individuals. Now, when you look into traditional media, if you look at Middle East in general, all the media institutions are affiliated with some political agenda, religious sect. So then you're facing the other obstacle of how will they disseminate this content and will it reach the audience that you intended to reach? So why did we identify satire? Because the community of Iraq, being a post-war society, have always suffered from, you know, all the strains of political decisions and all the social issues that came after war. So they need something lighter for us to be able to attract their attention so that we can get our content across, so we can get our message to these individuals. So satire played a significant role for us. Also, the other motivation for using animation was that, don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, we had the ruling of ISIL for over a year and a half in a significant geographical location where they had schoolings and they were teaching young kids how to conduct assassination operations, how to conduct other tactical operations. So we had to have some medium or some mean of getting back to the psychology of these age groups and to be able to disseminate content to them. So for us, really on the ground, is really dependent on what the capabilities are. And as again, just because something goes viral, that doesn't mean that the objective has been reached. But coming back to the donor issue, a donor needs to justify how this money was spent. And they need to see statistical data to tell them, okay, so this was money well spent. And that kind of becomes a big, huge obstacle in the way the operations are conducted in order for you to be effective. So majority of this time for us, really, unfortunately, is to satisfy the donor rather than focus on the effectiveness of the message, whether it's reached the target or it hasn't.
I want to go back to you, Michael, just quickly, because it has occurred to me that both Rwanda and Huda are working sort of with Islamist agendas in terms of, you know, counter-Islamist messaging. I have found it, and Jesse, I know you've worked a little bit in India as well, much more difficult to work on communication strategies when you are actually dealing with Hindu, white nationalist, or Buddhist extremism. Michael, in your report, did you come across much programming that was sort of focused not on Islamist extremism, or was it nearly all focused on Islamist extremism?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the vast majority of the content that we were able to dig up, at least partially, if not exclusively, focused on various sort of forms of Islamist extremism or violent extremism.
Jesse, maybe you can make a comment here, because I know that you have tried to initiate programming on other forms of extremism.
So when you have things like that, you're really limited, because even organizations or international organizations that should be focusing on other types of programming, but the donors don't really want to fund programs, and then the organizations still don't even feel comfortable going into countries, maybe due to the country's political ties or economic ties. So then you go back to the kind of status quo and go back to the what everyone else is going to, which is the Islamist programming. So again, you get the same kind of programs, the same kind of run-of-the-mill, unless if you start thinking outside the box and you try to implement other programs.
Going back to Rwanda and Huda, when you are doing your monitoring and evaluation for the donors, can you talk us through Rwanda, what they require you to do? Because some of the projects you work on are large and some of them are small, and monitoring and evaluation is very expensive.
In all these projects, the main obstacle is satisfying the donor's reach by proving it through numbers. For example, emojis has become a great reaction by people when they see something. Instead of typing something, they kind of just give one of these emojis. And in some donors doesn't consider them as a clear indication of reactions. In Iraq, we have about 19 million Facebook users out of 42 million. And as we are all aware now, Facebook is becoming more difficult as a medium in order for you to be promoting content. The algorithm becomes very, very strange. They're very cautious now because they're worried about these robotic systems that, you know, promote content or promote messaging or marketing or whatnot. So really, it's not just a matter of for someone like us to come up with an effective message. A lot of emphasis is put onto how to deliver it and how to get a feedback in order for you to satisfy the donor.
Huda, could you talk us through how the donors work with you on your projects?
One of the specific things that I keep emphasizing them, one product cannot be used for so many different purposes. So I tend to focus, let's say, because we are seeing now here in Singapore, for instance, the rise of radicalization among migrant workers. So I cannot use my film Jihad Selfie, with story about the 16-year-old boy who wanted to join ISIS while he was studying abroad, to engage with this migrant worker community. I need to produce a film, a product that this targeted community can easily relate. But analysts, my initiative is always again pointy and targeted. I call it hyper-local communication approach, because and then we can measure. Okay, I want to target specific community using that specific messaging.
Michael, if I can just hop back to you, because a lot of the issues that were raised in your report were to do with, you know, how do we measure the effectiveness
of these interventions? I mean, it's so difficult. What can we do to better understand whether the goals are being achieved here?
Most of these programs are short-term, often sort of pilot programs that, you know, are implemented from 2 months through to a year and a half. And frankly, anywhere along that spectrum is not going to be enough time to really sort of understand the longer term impacts that you've had. So I think it's a question of both monitoring and evaluation, but also the sort of parameters and expectations that donors impose on programs as well. And so understanding that you're not going to have a concrete, you know, idea of if an individual has been truly reformed over the duration of their lifetime, bar a set of indicators that measure it in months. I mean, it's just not going to be workable. I know, having spoken to a lot of other researchers and programmers, you know, operating in this space, a lot of people are aware this is the case. I mean, these aren't new or sort of revolutionary findings, but they do continue to sort of frame a lot of the work that's taking place at the moment. So I think it's both improving on the technical side, the specific indicators and sort of monitoring and evaluation approaches that people are using, but also reforming the wider sets of parameters and conditions that people are actually operating under going forward.
I'd like to turn to Jesse as somebody who's worked closely with donors and country level partners. What do you see as the focus moving forward then in terms of best practice, working towards a stronger impact and stronger measurement as well, really? What can and should be done, or what should be done better?
And so thinking of whether it was satire, whether it was comedy, whether it had to be beauty, fashion, or something completely different, but it still resonated with them. It was thinking differently and not your typical programming with donors and moving forward. I think that if we continue the way or have people like this who are still interested in making these programs better and looking again at the gaps and what's failed and not keep doing the status quo, because if we keep doing the status quo, we're always going to be behind. And we're never going to be able to keep up. And we have to keep informing the donors and saying, this doesn't work.
So moving on to you, Huda, for a final sort of comment. Do you think it's working? Do you think the communications interventions are working?
I think it's wrong to assume that terrorism communication is not working. It's working, but it is wrong also to assume that only through communication we can achieve something. Because terrorism has been preying on human desire to belong. And terrorists knows very well how to play with this, and oftentimes through something unexpected, you know. So even like through footballs, you know, all this, even through cooking, through tiny everyday negotiation of identity.
I just want to let Michael have a final comment, seeing he provided the report that frames so much of our conversation tonight. So Michael, any concluding thoughts?
I entirely agree that communications is one ingredient in a much more complex and wider sort of ecosystem of interventions that, you know, are necessary to tackle this. So it's difficult to say whether or not communications in themselves have worked. The programs that tend to work tend to be very locally focused and quite small. And so they tend to have traction because they have all of that contextual awareness, they have those networks within the community, but they're often very resource poor. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of research into how to adequately scale up those very locally focused interventions in a way that makes them sustainable without losing that nuance and granularity that actually allowed them to be effective in the first place. So I think a little more research is needed to see how we can better systematize and sustain a lot of these interventions, which maybe have quite good results, even an outcome and impact level, but aren't necessarily able to sort of sustain that in the timeframes that you'd really need to see some genuine change.
Thanks to Jesse, Rowand, Huda and Michael for joining me today. If this is your first time joining us, then thanks for listening. The Oslo Governance Centre is part of the United Nations Development Programme's Governance and Peacebuilding Cluster. You can follow the work of the OGC on UNDP's Twitter, Facebook, YouTube and Instagram pages, or on the Oslo Governance Centre's website.